So, the story of the Bible, we continue on. It's a long book, isn't it? There's 66 books in it. And so, we're going to look at three or four of them today. There seems to be there's lots of themes running through it. We're looking for the big picture. What are the things that keep reoccurring? And it seems to me that you could sum up a lot of what I've talked about, Paul has talked about, Tim's talked about, in one little phrase, which is, God is large and in charge. That's actually a book. I covered that, but our professor in seminary used to use that term all of the time. And we come to realize that YWAM, which is Youth with a Mission, has a training that they do for their young folks before they send them out in missionary work. And they start out with two basic facts. Fact number one is, there is a God. And fact number two is, you aren't Him. And so those are real important things to know and understand. Because if you think you can take His job, I just want to remind you that He's large and in charge. And large is even such a weak word. I'm going to be covering the time between Moses and essentially the kings, Saul and David. So the space in between, Joshua, Judges, a little bit of Samuel, and talk about the things that happened over that time. Joshua was the one who was taking over for Moses when Moses died. Because of somewhere between disobedience and temper tantrum, Moses did not get a chance for himself to go into the Promised Land. Promised Land was Israel. And so Joshua was the man of the day. He was the man who was going to take them, the people, from the desert across into Israel, into the Promised Land. As a matter of fact, it's interesting that Joshua, his name, actually means the Lord saves. It's Yeshua in Hebrew. And then in the Greek time, that name changes a little bit to become Jesus, which means the Lord saves. So you can see there's a theme there that God has of, there were a lot of Jesuses back in Jesus' time, and there was probably a lot of Joshuas back in Joshua's time, and actually probably today there's a lot of Joshuas. There's a lot of Jesuses now, but I don't think there's that many Jesuses. But Moses sends 12 spies over into this land because he's heard all kinds of rumors, good and bad. Land of milk and honey, nothing can be quite that easy, so let's send some spies. So he sends 12 spies over. And there's all stories of that I won't go into, but they come back. 10 of them go, oh my gosh, it is scary over there. You wouldn't believe it. We're like grasshoppers compared to the people there. They're all big giants and monsters over there, and I don't know how in the world we're ever going to take this country, take this land over from these folks. I mean, they're going to whoop us, you know. And so Moses hears that. But there's two of the spies who come back with a completely different story. And those spies are Joshua and Caleb. And they go, this is a land flowing with milk and honey. There is so much possibility there. There's so much that with God's power we can do. This is the promised land, and God's going to give it to us. I mean, it seems like that's sort of a picture of people today. I mean, you'd have the funny half empty, half full kind of thing. But God is calling people who have a picture, a vision of what can be done in a situation that looks absolutely impossible. As a matter of fact, I think there's a time in which it's almost a key element of God working is that it looks absolutely impossible. There's a way in which, say, that God calls a church to real renewal, and he's planning on pouring his Holy Spirit out to them, and he ends up whittling down to 16 people on a Sunday morning. And you go, this is impossible. How are we going to change Monroe? But that's the call that he has. He wants people who have eyes to see the way he sees it and understand that he can do what he says he's going to do. I remember the one scripture that Paula read two or three times about God saying, I'm going to have my way. That was in Isaiah. Nothing's going to stop me. That's the title of all of this. So he's going to do it. And if he's going to do it, he's going to do it. So, as a matter of fact, he even starts out the journey with Joshua. He calls them to cross the Jordan during flood season, which would be now, I would think, for us anyway. And so it's like impossible to cross the Jordan in flood season. So guess what he does? He parts the water so they can go across. I mean, how cool of a repeat sign is that? You know, it's like getting their attention. So I'm going to go back to this story in a minute, but I want to segue a little bit to a couple of things that I think you ought to see in a bigger picture. I mean, Moses is the one who has written the Pentateuch. The Pentateuch is the first five books of the Bible. And he's written them, okay? Now, you know he hasn't written Joshua, because it starts out Moses died. So unless he's really good, we have a new author of the Bible coming in. The Bible has one consistent author, which is the Holy Spirit, and then it has different people that God has called. So this is a story of Joshua coming in. So, but before we look at Joshua, one last look at Moses, because Moses has taken that time and spent 2 years on the mountain to get the law, to write, I mean, Deuteronomy, Numbers, most of it is pretty boring stuff if you sit and read it. But if you take it in the context of the story, it's, here's how life works. If you do this, it's going to work. If you don't, it's not going to work. If you don't do this, you'll be okay. If you do it, not so good. And so that's the repeating theme. So it's the law, but the law isn't a rule book. It's a way of life. It's a way of doing things. And God's saying, the law is about me. God, not me, God, but God. And so Deuteronomy 8 says to us, keep and live out the entire commandment that I'm commanding you today, so that you will live and prosper and enter and own the land that God promised to your ancestors. Let me go do that again. You'll live, prosper, enter, and own the land that God promised to your ancestors. Now, this is way before the spies went out. Remember every road that God led you on for those 40 years in the wilderness, pushing you to your limits, testing you so that he would know what you were made of, whether you could keep his commandments or not. He put you through some hard times. Thank heaven none of us have to go through any hard times, right? He made you go hungry. Then he fed you with manna, something neither of you nor your parents knew anything about, so you would learn that men and women don't live by bread alone. We live by every word that comes from God's mouth. Your clothes didn't wear out and your feet didn't blister for those 40 years. You learned deep in your heart that God disciplines you in the same way a father, a loving father, disciplines his child. This is actually out of the Message, so that's why it sounds so familiar of language. He goes on and says, if you forget God, your God, and start taking up with other gods and serving and worshiping them, I'm on record right now as giving you a firm warning. That will be the end of you. I mean it. destruction. You'll go to your doom, the same as the nations God is destroying before you. Doomed because you won't obey the voice of God, your God. Remember, he said, I will be your God, and you will be my people, and I will dwell with you. And when he dwells, he's taking up residence in our lives in a place where there's not room for other gods. And yet we still keep wanting to put other gods in our life. And you go, well, what's that? You know, I don't follow Hindu or whatever. No, I'm talking about putting other things, created things, in place of God. Trusting not in God, but in those things. But God has promised a land of milk and honey. Now Joshua realized that God was telling him, what he was telling him to do was greater than anything he could possibly do on his own. He needed to hear, obey, and follow God. And that's what he's calling us to do in our life. We go into it going, this isn't going to work. I don't see what you're doing here. I don't like this. This doesn't feel good. But God's going, trust me. Just hang on. I mean, as Joshua goes in, the first battle he fights is in Jericho. And what Joshua does is he gets the artillery out and he gets the big howitzers. No, that isn't what he does. Actually, what happens is as he's approaching Jericho, an angel of the Lord appears to him. That would be handy to have. I would love to have that happen. And the angel of the Lord comes to him and says, I am the commander of the army of the Lord. And I'm going to go before you. That helps a whole lot. We are in a battle. We are in a fight. And we need to know that the commander of the army of the Lord is with us in that fight. As long as we trust in God. As long as we put our trust in him. So Jericho is fallen, as you can see there, not by the hand of man, but by the hand of God. They're worshiping God. They're marching around many, many times around the city. And then finally, God says, blow your trumpets. Play your drums, your electric guitars, and your keyboards. And let that wall fall down. And that's how he wins. He actually goes on to a country or a town by the name of Ai, A-I. And doesn't trust in God, and he ends up in all kinds of trouble. So he's kind of a slow learner. And we're going to find that to be a theme, but just before we get to that, I want to back off again. I'm going to keep looking at the big picture as I'm talking about these stories. The big picture of the story of the Bible has an interesting characteristic. As historians have been looking at the movements of the Bible through the Old Testament, through the New Testament, what they recognize, what they see is God seems to work in 500-year portions. So every 500 years, a whole new thing happens. I want to show you a video. And the video is, the speaker is Phyllis Tickle. And she is a religious editor, but she is on the cutting edge of what's happening in the church today. And I've seen her speak a couple of times, and I'm very impressed with her. She has a feel for all of church. Would you kill the lights? And so just to give you the background of her, listen what she says about this whole idea of 500 years.
The Great Emergence is the name we're giving to the current upheaval that is certainly across all of Western culture and to some extent globally. It tries to name something that happens every 500 years. The Episcopal tradition has a Bishop Mark Dyer, who says when he gets right here that to understand the Great Emergence, what you really have to understand first is that about every 500 years the church feels compelled to have a giant rummage sale, and we're having one. And he's absolutely right. 500 years ago was, of course, the Great Reformation of 1517. 500 years before that was the Great Schism of 1051. 500 years before that was the Council of Chalcedon, the fall of Rome, the age of Gregory the Great, just to keep the greats going. 500 years before that was what's now being called increasingly the Great Transformation, the change of the eras. If we were a Jewish audience, some rabbi would rise up and say, it's not a Christian phenomenon, it's a Judeo-Christian, because 500 years from the Great Transformation, what we have, of course, is the Babylonian captivity and the end of First Temple Judaism, the birth of Second. 500 years before that, we have the Davidic dynasty out of which Meshua is to come. So, the Great Emergence, it's an every 500-year phenomenon. We're just lucky. We get to live through one.
Where is it going? If you don't realize that this is a special time in history, I don't know how special. I want to believe that Jesus is coming in this time, as every one of those they wanted to believe that. Will he? Only the Father knows. But the 500-year cycle, I think, is fascinating. I don't think she even went far enough. You talk about Abraham is where you start, 2000 BC. And then, if you remember, between Abraham and Moses, there was 400 years of being slaves in Egypt. So the spaces between these can get kind of rough. And then Moses comes and frees the people. And then I'm going to tell you some things about the space between Moses and David. And we'll talk about, that's what we're talking about today. And between David and Daniel is some really rough times. Solomon takes the church to its greatest place and then crashes it, or the people of Israel. And so 500 years there's exile, where they get sent out to Babylonian captivity. And then the 400 years I'll talk about in a couple weeks, between there and, it's actually the space between the Old Testament and the New Testament. So you have to go cheat and read some other stuff to find out about it, because they don't write it. And then, of course, Jesus comes, and he's sort of the pivot point. And then she says 500 AD is the Council of Chalcedon. May not mean anything to you, but we have, I'm losing track of the name of it. The Apostles' Creed. It really boils down what we really believe in as Christians. That was no little chore, and they put it together. It was also the development of things like the philosophy or the theology of Trinity and so forth. 1000 AD, the Great Schism, Orthodox Church, Catholic Church. Then you had a time of turmoil after that, in which we had the Crusades, which were not real good. And then at the 1500s, the Great Reformation. Martin Luther nails his treatise on the door of the church. The Protestantism is created, which we are part of. And there are people before him, like Zwingli and some of those. And there are people with him, such as Calvin, some of those. So that's a great time. And then 500 years later is now. And what is now? That's what we're discovering. But there's a possibility that it's something important just by looking at the calendar for the past 4,000 years. So just put that in your head. Some of the things we're running into are things that will be very important. So I want to talk about the spaces in between. In particular, the space between Moses and David. That's the task I have for today. Now, people of Israel, these are kind of cycles. The people of Israel seem to live in a cycle that they seem to repeat over and over and over again. The book of Judges gives us a good idea of what God thought of this. It is, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. Let me just say, especially in God's perspective, that doesn't work very well. I'd also like to say that if you really think about it for more than 30 seconds, you'll realize we're in a time like that. where everyone does as they see fit. You hear that philosophy? You've heard me say it until it's nauseating, that people are just going to do what they're going to do. They're going to believe what they believe, and nobody's going to tell me what to do. And chaos breaks out when that kind of thing happens. All right, despite Moses, the Red Sea, the manna in the desert, and all of that, the Jewish people begin to turn away from God. They've just taken the land. It's not real secure, but it's there. And so as you read through Joshua's the book that talks all about them going into the land, Judges is the next book of the Bible. And you see something repeated over and over again in Judges. You see a phrase, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 2. Chapter 3, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 4, the Israelites once again did evil in the... I mean, there seems to be something repeating here. It's a cycle that they're stuck in. They're stuck in the mud of what kind of trust they're going to have in God, in the living God. Because it isn't just that Joshua and Caleb had the vision, they had the trust in God, they took him in and brought him into the land, but they needed to keep the land. They needed to secure it. And the only way they could do that was to trust in God and focus on Him and not fall back to other gods, other ways of doing things. God raised up a number of people, but this is sort of the pattern. This is the cycle. In this pattern, you have the people turn from God, those things I'm reading. God judges by delivering the people to their enemies. The people turn back to God and go, oh my gosh, what were we thinking? Man, life really sucks now. God sends a judge to rescue the people. Now, the judge isn't to put everybody in prison. The judge is, we need to get back to the law. And the law isn't just a bunch of rules. It's turning our hearts back to Christ. So the judges that he brings are those who draw them out of the other gods that they're worshiping and into Christ. And then there's a period of peace under that judge. And then, oh my gosh, everything's good now. We're in the land of milk and honey. You know, actually, we thought it was maybe God doing this, but it's probably we're just great now. We're wonderful people, and we can do it without God. And look at how rich and prosperous we are. So we don't need God. And they hit that and turn the corner back again. And so you could see this over and over again. There are five different judges that are brought into the book of Judges. Ehud, a lone hero from the tribe of Benjamin who delivers Israel from the oppression of the east. He's the judge of that day, but then they flip right back again. So they bring in Deborah, of all things, a woman. Who could imagine that? He actually has a woman leading the Israelites. A woman from one of the Joseph tribes, who judges at a time when Israel is being overrun by Canaanites. Remember, that's their big enemies over and over again. Now, we have here talked about, I don't know if you were all here or not, probably not, but we did some things last summer about Gideon. Boy, Gideon is something else. He has a great story. He's the perfect classic example of what God's doing. Gideon is thrashing his wheat in the wine press. Well, first of all, you go, why does somebody thrash the wheat in the wine press? Why doesn't he thrash it out in the field? And the answer is he's hiding from the enemies of Israel. Because basically he's a coward. He is a coward. If you asked him, are you a coward? He would say, yes, I'm a coward. I'm hiding here. So God goes, there's a good guy. I'm going to pick him. So God comes down and says, I want you to lead my people. And he's looking, who? You know, me? Are you kidding? I'm in the weakest tribe in all of Israel. And I am the weakest guy in that tribe. And God's going, yes, that's what I'm looking for. I want you to know that it isn't just by your own strength that this has happened, but that it's because I have done this. So he calls together an army. So Gideon goes out and calls an army together. He gets 32,000 people, which is nowhere near enough to take on the enemy. It's way too small of an army. But then God goes, well, wait, you've got too many people. And he's going, what? And he keeps paring them down through different selection process till he gets to 300 people. I mean, you're talking about hundreds of thousands on the other side. It's like not even close, which, again, is what God kind of likes. And so he tells Gideon, okay, now you're ready. Take your swords along, but put them down right now. I want you to have clay pots with fire, with oil in it for fire, and trumpets. And then God goes into the camp of the enemy and gives them all a dream in which they're being overthrown by this huge army. So then he calls on Gideon to go ahead and make all kinds of racket, and they smash the pots and the fire flies all over the place and they blow their trumpets, and the enemy begins to kill themselves, running over each other just to get away. And all that that Gideon has to do is clean up after. Again, God's saying, do you get it? He's saying to you today, do you get it? Do you get what I'm doing? Do you see what I'm saying? You say, who, me? I'm no one who can do this kind of stuff. And God goes, exactly. This is exactly what I want, people who can't do this kind of stuff. You have Jephthah, a social outcast from the other Joseph tribe, which is Manasseh, who judges at a time in Israel is being threatened by a coalition of powers under the king, Ammon. I mean, Jephthah is the fourth judge. So, I mean, you're talking about in a period of 300-400 years that this is all happening over and over and over again. And finally, and this is one we probably know the best, is Samson, the lone hero from the tribe of Dan who delivers Israel from oppression from the West. But he has sort of a rocky life in doing that. It's not smooth going in. It's something in which it's pretty tough. Now, I was going to peel off the video for Samson, but I found one that's a little different. You know, I've been showing you little strips of video from the mini-series, The Bible, that, who was it, the Learning Channel or the History Channel, History had. And so I want to show you the guy on there who played Samson. It's a little surprising to me when I saw it the first time because he's African-American. And I'm going, whoa, I didn't think of Samson that way, but... Anyway, listen to what he has to say.
My name is Nonso Nozier, and I play Samson in the Bible. Well, when I landed the role of Samson, I was over the moon. It was an amazing opportunity to help tell the story of the Bible. As a Christian, I jumped at the chance. The last time I had been to church before I got the news, my pastor had given me a scripture to read to the congregation, as she often does. And the scripture happened to be Judges and the story of Samson. So I kind of took it as a sign from God that I've got to be part of this show. I think the message that we can take from Samson's story is that no matter how strong you are and successful you are, you can always fall. We all have weaknesses, and he was a man of great faith and great strength, but he let his weakness in and took his eye off God for a moment, and that was his downfall. Thank you. What is your name?
My name is Delilah.
He is strong, faithful, and naive. He's a good man at heart, but I think here the route to his destruction is that he follows his passions instead of his responsibilities.
My name's Kirsten Waring, and I play Delilah in the Bible series. Delilah had these two choices, money or love.
It's all for you.
And at the end of the day, she went for the money. Even though she had feelings for Samson and she was in love with him.
How does he make you strong?
My mother was barren. God brought her a child, me. But there are things I must not do.
Such as?
If I cut my hair.
What, my love? What if you cut your hair?
My God will take away all my strength. I'll be as weak as everyone else. My hope for the Bible series is that it will bring more and more people closer to God. If that's for people to see it and say, I don't remember that story being quite like that in the Bible, and that makes them go and pick up their Bible and go and read it and study it a bit more. Or if it inspires someone in some way to pray a bit more or to help others or to live like Jesus, then if that can do that for one person, let alone the millions of people that are going to watch it, then the job is big.
So what you see is God says, okay, if you thought all I do is pick weaklings and make them strong, let me give you a strong man, a real powerful man, and then let him humble himself. Let him weaken himself. Would you do me a favor and turn the lights back on? And so Samson is the man. His weaknesses are women. And when you see him first talking to Delilah, you just want to go, run, Samson, run. Get out of there. But what we find is someone who ultimately, in the story, he gets his hair cut, he loses his power. They blind him. They do all kinds of things to him, the enemy. And they have him there so long that they don't realize his hair's growing back. And he gets to the point where he's strong again, but now he's blind. And so he just finds the temple columns. He asks them where they're at, and they tell him stupidly. And he just pushes everything down, and everything caves in on himself, too. God's saying, even when I give you strength, even when I give you success, even when I give you power, that doesn't mean now you're on your own. Okay, God, give me enough power and I'm going to go do what you want me to do, and I know exactly what you want me to do because I have it all figured out. No, that doesn't work that way. So the timing of our story is a rocky time. It's a tough time. Remember, it's the time between Moses and the coming king, David. There is no king. Remember we said it's a time where there was no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. There is no king. Now, it isn't that Israel had kings, but they had leaders. They had Abraham. They had Moses. They wanted somebody like that again. They wanted somebody to tell them what to do. I mean, I think that same kind of thing happens in a church setting, where people go, well, I'm just going to let the pastor tell me what to do. I mean, there's plenty of them that say, I'm not going to let anybody tell me what to do, but or I'm going to let the pastor do all that. But what God's calling us to do is to do our own study, to seek him out ourselves. What I need is a whole group of people who are all hearing God and can help me to do that, and I can help them to do that. So you can see that again and again, God's making a statement to the Israelites. What is that statement? I'll give you a hint. It starts with, he is large. He is large and in charge. He's the man of the hour for us. He's there for us. Now, He wants to use us in the battle. He wanted to use the Israelites in the battle. But I want to show you an example. Now we're into the book of 1 Samuel, which we're heading towards the time in which we will see the kings, but that'll be in a coming episode in the future. But God is a God who's large and in charge. He's powerful, and he can protect himself. He can handle things on his own. He really actually doesn't need us. What was it that you read in Isaiah? What he says is going to happen is going to happen. With or without us? Well, the Israelites end up, of all things, losing the Ark of the Covenant. The place where God is, where the Ten Commandments are inside the Ark. And they end up losing it. I don't know if they came home one night and said, honey, I lost the Ark of the Covenant or what. But and so the Philistines take it. Remember, this is the future home of Goliath and the gang. And the Philistines have captured the Ark of the Covenant. And they've got it. And there's no one from Israel around to protect it. So, oh my gosh, what's going to happen to the Ark of the Covenant? Well, let's find out what happens to the Ark of the Covenant. It says, after the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, they took it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then they carried the Ark into Dagon's temple and set it beside Dagon. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back up in his place. So they bring the Ark of the Covenant into Dagon's temple, and the statue of Dagon that night falls in front of the Ark, because God is God. He is the greatness. Let's keep going. After the Philistines had captured the Ark of God, but the following morning when they rose, there was Dagon fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. Again, he did this. His head and hands had been broken off, and they were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. That's why to this day, neither the priests of Dagon nor any others will enter Dagon's temple at Ashdod, step on the threshold. I mean, God can take care. I don't need anyone else, God says. I'm there. Other gods, other idols are going to bow before me. Our idols are going to bow before God. We put our reliance on other things, and they're going to crash. There's a lot of things going to crash. I mean, if we're in that 500-year cycle, I think we may get an idea that things might be different than they were in the past. And we don't want to be a people who rely on ourselves or on our gods or on Wall Street or Hollywood or sports or whoever or whatever it is that we're relying on, but that we know that God is calling us, no matter what's happening. Now, there's a lot of things that are happening, a lot of things that happen in our life that don't feel like it's God in them. It seems like things aren't working out. And I want to say there are three possibilities in life when we're running into things that just don't seem to be going right. And the three possibilities are that challenges come from God. Judgment for the things we have done and turned away from God, just like in Israel in these times where he turned them over to their enemies. Number two is a spiritual attack could be happening to hinder us from doing God's will. We're in a battle. Even though we have the angel of the Lord and the commander of God's army with us, we don't always turn to that. And finally, testing by God. You saw that when he had the people in the desert. To see what faith we have, what kind of faith we have in him, and if we are all, Oops, I got part of it chopped off, but we're all talking to him. And so, and I have to tell you that there's another option to this, which is two or more of these at the same time. God can be giving us what we deserve for what we've done wrong. It can be then there's a pile on of spiritual attack in our life. And it can be God's testing us to see if we're going to turn to Him and walk our way through it. So what I want to say is God is calling us to trust in Him. He's calling us to understand and know that we have that same army of the Lord standing around us. That He wants to work in our lives in that same way. But He won't push in. He won't make us do anything. We have a free will. The key thing we have to do is choose to turn to Him. I want to take some time to just really open things up again to ministry. A time of just wanting to